would like to thank you for your hospitality and having us as part of your youth rally again. For all the folks who kept kiddos and fed kiddos, and especially my good friends, the Colliers, that I guess every time I'm here, I get to sleep in their wonderful home and eat at their wonderful table. I don't know that maybe Troy did better than I did because he was at his grandparents' house. He said something about chocolate gravy. I don't know, but he was smiling, and he never smiles that way when I take him out to eat, so I don't know what the deal was. But thank you guys for hosting. I hope all the men who played football yesterday aren't limping. I'm not yet. We'll see what happens maybe as I ride the van home. If you have your Bibles and want to follow along this morning, they've kind of assigned some topics to me for this weekend. Yesterday we talked about reusing or recycling the blood of Jesus. And the topic today is waste not, want not, from Ephesians chapter 5. I'd like to start in verse 15 and kind of give us a jumping off spot. In the New King James Version, this says, redeeming the time because that you know the days are evil. The version I'm reading this morning, and I chose it because of this translation, says, be very careful then how you live. Do not be unwise, but wise, making the most of every opportunity because the days are evil. The idea about time management, how you use your time. So you really can't reuse time. The woman from Tekoa, when she enters into David's court and is trying to tell him a story to make him sympathetic to bringing Absalom back into the kingdom, she says, what are our lives? Our lives are like water spilt on the ground and cannot be gathered up. You don't redeem time. Because you can't buy it back. Once it's gone, it's gone. I've often said that we should not count our days as up. Now, I do the same thing you do. I celebrate my birthday. This year, I was real happy to see my birthday show up. There were some iffy points there that I might not roll over to big 4-6. But I was happy to. But really, we're not getting older. We should be born with a clock that counts down. Because from the day you're born, you're dying. And that's it. And it's really not about, you know, if you took an hourglass and you turned it upside down and I said, hey, this hourglass has been running for 25 minutes. This hourglass has been running for 26 minutes. You'd be looking at the sand that's left in that glass. You wouldn't care how long it's been running. You'd be worried about what's left in it. When we start thinking about how we use our time, what we start doing with our choices, when we start talking about our availability, rather than counting up, we really need to understand, folks, we're counting down. That we're on a time clock. And some of us aren't guaranteed very much. I'm not a full-time minister. I have a private office. I do counseling. One of the things that I didn't enjoy about being a full-time minister was being a minister in a small town means you get to do the funerals. And it didn't matter if they went to your church or not. Folks, at 23 years old, I had stood beside more open holes in the ground than I could possibly have imagined. And I've buried more kids than I'd care to talk about. I'm not a stranger to death or violence. I work as a police chaplain. And I've stepped over bodies and around pools of blood. And I've picked up motorcycle helmets with heads still in them. I'm not very shocked by the things that can happen to a human body. I am always shocked when the coffin is very small. I just somehow not prepared for that. A little girl died one time in the hospital just a few days old, and her parents contacted me because I'm affiliated with the city. They weren't church members. And I went out to a private gravesite and performed a little eulogy for this little girl. Well, they'd had her cremated. And what was left of her fit inside a silver egg. And when they moved the parents away to uncover the grave, the little lady sat there. And she said, I don't want to leave. I'm afraid they'll lose her. I'm afraid they'll misplace her. I said, ma'am, if you'll go away and not look at this hole when they uncover it, I'll personally put her in the ground. The mom left. The funeral director laid that little egg in my hand. And when they moved those carpets back, instead of it being a big square, they just dug a post hole. And I got down on my knees and put that little girl in there. I don't guess I'll ever get over that. Folks, it doesn't matter how big you are or how small you are. You don't have a lot of time on this planet. And it doesn't even matter if you live to be 80 or 90. That's not a lot of time when you compare it to other things. So how do we make every opportunity? How do we fulfill what we're supposed to do and use our time wisely? James comments on this in the letter that he writes to the Christians that are dispersed. James chapter 4, it's a very familiar passage. But he talks about the kind of plans that we make and the kind of things that we do. James chapter 4, verse 13. Listen now. The old King James Version says, go to now. I like that. It's kind of like playing Monopoly. Go to jail. Do not pass go. Go directly to jail. He says, go to now. He doesn't talk about go to the past. He doesn't talk about go to the future. He says, go to now. He says, stop right here on this square in reality. Go to now. You that say today or tomorrow, we'll go to this city and spend a year there. We will buy and sell and get gain. But what is the morrow? What is your life? It is but a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Rather, what you ought to say is, if it is the Lord's will, we shall do this or that. And you boast and you brag, and all such boasting is evil. Anyone then who knows the good that he ought to be doing and does not do it commits a sin. James says when you start talking about time management, you should start asking yourself, not what am I going to do tomorrow? Not worry about what did I not do yesterday, but what am I doing with what I've got right here, right now? Redeeming the time. Living wisely, taking advantage of our opportunities. And by the way, opportunity equals responsibility. If it's your opportunity, it's your responsibility. And when we get opportunities to do good and when we get opportunities to do right, James says, if you have an opportunity to do good and you don't do it, then you're overlooking something God has wanted you to do. Therefore, to him that knows to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. So when we talk about using our time and managing our time and reusing or redeeming the time, it's really about what are we doing with the opportunities that God presents us? What are we doing in making our time management and our plans? And time is an interesting thing. Because it doesn't matter how rich you are, it doesn't matter how young you are, it doesn't matter how old you are, it doesn't matter how poor you are, it doesn't matter how sick you are, it doesn't matter how healthy you are, you've got as much time today as I do. You got 24 hours if we finish the day. And that's it. And James says when you start talking about how you use your time, you should say, first of all, if it's the Lord's will, we'll do this or that. And really, I've gotten in the habit for several years, and even more so this year, people will invite me to do something or go somewhere, and I will say, I will see you on this date if the Lord allows us to fulfill our plans. Because we're not always guaranteed that we will fulfill our plans. We're not always guaranteed that we're going to be residents on this planet. The death rate on planet Earth is 100%. You got that? Now, you can argue Enoch and you can argue Elijah and lower my statistics. They left. They're not permanent residents here. Now, they didn't drop off and put it in the ground, but they're not here. You will not be a permanent resident on this planet. 100% death rate, period. It's done. So what are you going to do with what you've got? What are you going to do with the opportunities that are put before you? In the story of the woman of Tekoa, she comes to David and she gives him this sad story about her son. And David says, well, you need to redeem this boy. You need to bring him home. Nothing's going to happen to him. And she says, what you don't understand, King, is you've sort of convicted yourself. You've got a banished son, Absalom, that you haven't brought back to the kingdom. Well, David brings him back to the kingdom. Absalom is handsome. Ladies, it says that from the sole of his foot to the top of his head, there wasn't a blemish on him. He bought himself a chariot and had 50 men to run before him. Okay, he's got a sports car and a posse, all right? I mean, this guy's got it going on. He's a chick magnet. And he stands out in front of the gate, and he begins to tell people, well, you know, if I saw your case today, I would rule in your favor. And he begins to manipulate, and he begins to con people. And eventually, he takes over the castle. He storms Jerusalem. David leaves Jerusalem. He leaves Jerusalem and goes up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives. Now, it's probably the same route that Jesus takes when he leaves Jerusalem and goes up to the Mount of Olives to pray. The reason this is a good spot, one, people used to worship God there. Number two, you could sit on the Mount of Olives and see anything coming out of Jerusalem. You could defend it with a Boy Scout and a slingshot. No offense to Boy Scouts or slingshots. And so David goes to a tactically sound position on the Mount of Olives. He leaves the city. He leaves with his head covered. He leaves barefooted. And as he walks out, and he's camping out at night, he's gone without food, he's gone without provisions, he's gone without weapons. Well, Absalom has a war council. Ahithophel comes in and says, let me take 12,000 men. Let me take 12,000 men. Let me go out in the dark and find him, because I'll overwhelm him. I'll overwhelm him with terror. I'll get him while he's tired. I'll get him while he's angry. I'll get him while he's weary and exhausted. And tomorrow morning, you'll be king of Israel. Hushai is kind of a spy for David. He met David on the Mount of Olives and said, I'll go with you. David said, no. You go back and you present yourself to Absalom and you be a war council guy for him and you give him bad advice. And Hushai says, hey, look, you guys know David. David's not going to sleep with his people. He's going to get out here and get in a hole or in a cave somewhere, and he's going to be like hunting a she-bear in a cave with cubs. You better leave David alone tonight, and you wait till the sunlight comes up. You don't want to be in a fight with David, and you don't want to be in a fight with David at night. And Absalom listens to Hushai, and the decision to wait from dark to daylight cost Absalom his life. Had Absalom taken those 12,000 men, crossed the Kidron Valley, bounced up on the top of the Mount of Olives, you'd have the desert on one side, the Kidron Valley on the other. David would have been boxed in. It'd been trouble. But the decision to wait from daylight, he didn't take advantage of the opportunity. And I think God foiled his plans. But the bottom line was that Absalom wasn't using an opportunity. And the decision to wait one day cost him his life. Time is a funny thing. I want you to look at an interesting story with me about time. It's in the Gospel of Luke. Luke chapter 9, you've got Jesus coming down from the Mount of Transfigurations. Luke chapter 9, verse 37. Now the next day when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met him. A man in the crowd called out, Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only child. A spirit seizes him and he suddenly screams and it throws him into convulsions so that he foams at the mouth. It scarcely ever leaves him and is destroying him. I beg your disciples to drive it out. But they could not. Now, folks, I want you to remember that setup for the story. Look at Mark chapter 9. In Mark chapter 9, you have exactly the same story. The first thing I want you to understand is this guy comes to Jesus. And he says, I've got a son, and this son is possessed with a demon. I ask your disciples to cast it out, and they could not. Now, he doesn't say they would not. It didn't say that they said, hey, let's wait till we see Jesus. See, Jesus is taking Peter, James, and John going to the Mount of Transfiguration. So the crowds come up to the bottom of the mountain looking for Jesus, and his disciples are there, and they say, well, you know, he's not available. What do you need? And this guy says, well, I've got a son who's got a demon. These guys have just returned from the limited commission. He gave them power over demons. He gave them power to do miracles. So these guys are used to things kind of going their way. And all of a sudden, he says, I asked these guys to cast this demon out and they could not. Does that imply to you that they tried and failed? You ever told anybody you could do something and then couldn't back it up? Isn't that interesting? I love teenage boys. Because when a boy is 17 years old, he's as old as he's ever been. He's as strong as he's ever been. He's as fast as he's ever been. And at 17, they think they are men. And most of the time, they're not. And with no offense to those young men who I couldn't catch yesterday, there's a difference between a boy's strength and a man's strength. And you got a kid, no offense, who lifts weights and works out 2 or 3 hours a day for PE or football, and you've got a guy who carries shingles on a roof all day, or drives posts in the ground, or digs post holes, or works with his hands in concrete and blocks, or swings a maul or a hammer. And there's a kind of strength there you can't get in a gym, because there's no water breaks, everything's not balanced, and there's no mirrors to look at yourself. And there's just a little different kind of strength going on there. And sometimes a teenage boy will come up to me and say, "Mr. Lonnie, I can do more push-ups than you." All right, let's see what happens. Sometimes a teenage boy will say, "Well, I can lift this much weight," but then he can't pick up a bucket of water because water's not really balanced and it'll wiggle on you. There's all kinds of things. These disciples were in this position where they said, "Bring us that demon, we'll get rid of him." And the Bible says they could not. And in my mind, they had tried and failed. Now, in Mark, we get a little more detail here. Mark chapter 9, verse 14. When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the law arguing with them. So not only is this that they couldn't do it, now it has created some kind of tumult. They've got this conflict going on. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder, ran to meet him. Jesus said, "What are you arguing about?" A man in the crowd said, "Teacher, I brought my son to you who is possessed with a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth. He gnashes at his teeth. He becomes rigid. I ask your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not." "Oh, unbelieving generation," Jesus replied, "how long will I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." So they brought the boy to him. When the spirit saw Jesus, he immediately threw the boy into a convulsion, and he fell to the ground and rolled around foaming at the mouth. You understand that as soon as this spirit sees Jesus, he throws this boy into a convulsion? If this spirit will cut up this way in front of Jesus, what has he been doing to these disciples? Now, maybe I'm making an inference there that nobody else makes, but look, this Jesus tells this spirit, "You come out of the boy," and he convulses the boy. Folks, if he'll act that way in the presence of the Son of God, what kind of a picnic has he been having with these disciples? You teach vacation Bible school, and they bring that little boy in, and he's kicking his mama, he's pulling at her hair, and he's, "I don't want to go to vacation Bible school." If he acts that way with his mama, what's he going to do in your class? Aren't you just happy to see that little guy? Oh boy, he's here today, you know. We had a little kid in our youth group named Damien, and it was properly named. I mean, wow. This demon is showing that I've got power, and I'm in charge. I don't know if you've ever seen anybody have a convulsion or a seizure. It's an intimidating thing when you know there's a medical reason for it. Can you imagine seeing a person convulsed and seized and there be a demonic reason? Jesus doesn't seem to break his composure. He asks his father, he says, "How long has he been like this?" Verse 20, the father answers. Well, verse 21, Jesus said, "How long has he been like this?" "From childhood," he answered. "It has often thrown him into the fire and into the water to kill him. And if you can do anything, have pity on us and help us." Now, this is not my purpose in my lesson today, but this is kind of a timeout. Do you understand the pronouns here? Me, my, us, y'all, them. Who's got a demon in this passage? The boy, right? What does the phrase "help us" mean? You heard the old story about Tonto and the Lone Ranger? They ride out and they're surrounded by, 200,000 Indians. And the Lone Ranger says, "Tonto, what are we going to do?" He goes, "What you mean, we, Paleface?" You understand that we and that us is an inclusive thing. When this Father says, "Have mercy on us and help us," he doesn't have a demon. This man's not demon-possessed. It's just his kid. Young people, fifth grade and up, this guy is as much possessed by this demon as this boy is, because it's his boy. And if you don't understand that your parents feel every ounce of pain and every piece of disappointment and every hurt, and I don't know that there's a proper way to explain this to you. If you get bumped, your mom and daddy bruise. If you get a scratch, your mom and dad bleed. If you get frightened, your parents are terrified. Because the first time in our lives, we are vulnerable and powerless at the same time. I'm not scared of the dark. I've hunted since October the 15th and have not yet turned my flashlight on in the woods. If it's in the dark and wants me, get on. Let's see what happens. We talked about a little 45 automatic I carry sometimes. All right, I've got a knife I know how to use. And if it's in North Alabama and wants to crawl on top of me, I bet it'll crawl off real fast. I'm just not scared. There's not much in North Alabama that'll eat somebody my size. Now, out in Colorado, it may be a different story. I saw a picture from a camera in northern Kentucky of an 8-point buck being drug out of the woods by a cougar. Now, that's a big cat. That's not a little bobcat like we have in Alabama. That's a long-tailed big cat. I might not be as brave in northern Kentucky as I am in North Alabama. But young people, I am powerless to do things for my daughter. And I'm scared for her. And only when she came into my life did I understand what real fear was. Because she can get hurt, and she can make bad decisions, and she can do dumb things, and things can just happen to her that aren't anybody's fault, and I can't do anything about it. And her problems are my problems. Now, they probably shouldn't be. She's 20 now. But young people, you've got to understand that this man, when he's talking to Jesus, and it's not the purpose of this story, but he tells Jesus, "Because this boy suffers, I suffer." So young people, give your parents a break when they tell you you can't go, or they don't want you to hang out with that one, or they wish you wouldn't go here, or you can't do this right now. Because it's not because they want to ruin your life. It's not because they're disappointed in you. It's not because they've got something going on that... It's just because they understand that you can be hurt in so many ways that you don't comprehend, and anything that happens to you happens to them 100,000 times worse than it happens to you. Please understand that. So this father is feeling the pain of his son. Jesus replies in verse 23, "If you can believe, everything is possible to those who believe." Immediately the father exclaimed, "I do believe, help me overcome my unbelief." Jesus commands the spirit, "Come out." The spirit shrieked, convulsed the boy violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that many said he's dead. Jesus took him by the hand, lifted him to his feet, and the boy stood up. Fast forward. When they get down to the privacy, verse 28, the disciples ask, "Why couldn't we drive this demon out?" Jesus replied, "This kind can only come out by prayer and fasting." Now, I'm not sure what you know about demonology, and I probably know less. I do know that there are specific things that if you supposedly know the name of a demon, you can control it, that there's certain things you can say and do, and different demons behave different ways. Jesus tells his disciples, the reason you couldn't cast this demon out is this demon requires prayer and fasting. Now, is Jesus praying anywhere in this chapter? Shake your head this way. Is Jesus fasting anywhere in this chapter? Shake your head this way. This is not some magical incantation where, "Oh no, we've got to cast this demon out. Quick, offer me a Twinkie. No thank you, I'm fasting." No, that's not the way it works. Jesus is telling these guys, you couldn't cast this demon out because prior to meeting the demons, you hadn't been doing enough praying and fasting. He said, this battle with this demon was lost way before you ever met him because you hadn't been using your time wisely. See, folks, a sword never loses a battle. The fault is always with the swordsman. You give me a guy who's untrained, and I don't care what kind of weapon he's got, he can't use it. You give me a guy who's a master swordsman, and he'll beat you to death with a broom handle. In fact, one of the two famous samurai battles between two Ronin samurai, the guy who won the battle won it with a boat oar instead of a long blade. This particular samurai had an extension, had a longer samurai sword, and he challenged this other guy to a duel, and the guy shows up with a boat oar that he'd carved, and this way he couldn't, when he would slice with his sword, it would catch in the boat oar, and he would move it, and he hit the guy twice with a boat oar and killed him. A sword never lost a battle. The fault's always with the swordsman. Jesus says, you couldn't cast this demon out because prior to meeting the demon, you hadn't been making some choices about your time with prayer and meditation and fasting and doing some disciplines. Young people, you will lose to temptation, not in the day of temptation, but you lose to temptation days before the temptation. And adults, we do the same thing. So you decide to be honest way before somebody asks you the question you can lie about. You decide to be pure way before you park that car off in the side road to talk to somebody. You decide whether or not you're a man or a woman of integrity way before you get into the situation. And redeeming the time, using the time wisely, taking advantage of the opportunity is basically saying, what do I do with my time to prepare myself for either when it's time to serve God or time to resist the temptation? Because you win and lose those battles way before those battles show up. If you're 35 to 45 years old and the only time you played football this year was yesterday afternoon, you lost that battle before you stepped on that field. Because those boys that we chased all day yesterday, they do that for fun. I worked out with a guy who was a cross-country runner, and his shirt said, my sport is your sport's punishment. In other words, if you play basketball or football or baseball and the coach gets mad at you, he makes you run. He said, we run, that's what we do. You can't punish a cross-country runner by making him run, because that's all they do. So Jesus tells these disciples, you didn't win this battle because you didn't make some good choices. Stephen Covey has this interesting quadrant, I call it. At the top of the quadrant is the word important. At the bottom of the quadrant is the word unimportant. At this side of the quadrant is the word urgent. At this side of the quadrant is the word not urgent. So you have four squares, and you can put things that are urgent and important. And the things that are urgent and important, we take care of. Right? Like breathing. You want to be the master champion of Simon Says? Simon Says, hold your breath. You win that round. Because eventually they're going to pass out or start breathing, and you win. Urgent and important. It's the things you've got to do, and if you don't do it, something happens. Then you've got a category over here that's not urgent and not important, and you don't have to fool with that kind of stuff. But the two things that take place in the life of a Christian and the life of mature people in managing our time are the things that are urgent but not important. And that's where teenagers lose the battle, because it's that next concert ticket. It's that next movie. It's that next video game. It's, I've got to go to that celebration at school. If I don't have a prom dress. And we get so busy with things that are urgent. If you miss this, oh no! And really, if you miss this, big deal. I went coon hunting during my senior prom. Me and a red bone hound and two guys went and ran around the woods till after midnight chasing raccoons. I missed the senior prom. I have more memories of spending the time in the woods in the dark than I ever do of having to put on a tuxedo, trust me. All right? But we get wrapped up in the things that are urgent but not important. And interestingly enough, the other category is those things that are important but not urgent. See, if you got up this morning and you didn't pray, nobody's going to call you on it. If you got up this morning and didn't read your Bible, if you get up tomorrow morning and don't pray and don't study, it's not like you're going to walk into the office and somebody call you on the carpet, hey, realize you didn't study this morning. It's important, but nobody knows that you do it or don't do it. And we lose the battle for time by spending too much time on that which is urgent but not important and ignoring that which is important but not urgent. And when the apostle writes and says, you must take advantage and live wise, not unwise, what he's talking about is our ability to make choices about, I've only got so much time. Urgent and important is number one. Important and not urgent is number two. Urgent but not important is number three. And then urgent, unimportant, and unurgent are number four. And until we get those last, those middle two swapped, we spend so much of our time on what's urgent but not important. But when we begin to spend time on what's important but not urgent, that's when we win. That's when we make wise decisions. That's when we redeem our time. All of us have the same amount of time. You and I will be held accountable before God for how we use the time that's allotted to us. May God bless you in your choices for how you use your time. Thank you.